Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 86, section 3, which is old single column, page 952. All right, so we're rolling forward in this paper called The Early Evolution of Religion. Recall that last time we brought in the first of the elements that primitive religion is constructed around, the concept of chance. And then, you know, luck relative to individuals. And remember how they mentioned that right at the very end of section 2 there that, you know, that concept doesn't require any sort of a concept of, you know, spirit beings or anything like that. It can just be that vague, animistic spiritization of everything. You know, but remember they said right at the end there, animism isn't the only element that you build a primitive religion around. The other one is the whole ever complexifying concept of ghosts leading to spirits, you know, etc. And that's what we're going to get into tonight. And they need to give us a little context before they get to the meat of that mode of religiousizing mortals' lives. Because obviously you're not going to have this so-called ghost notion except through death. So they've got to talk about death and how that fires up the imagination and the illusory schemes in primitive man. And then we'll see there's another key element that comes into play to get the basic ghost cult phenomenon happening to go along with you know, a basically what's a nature cult sort of. You know. Okay, so let's take a look at what they have for us here.
Section 3, Death, the Inexplicable. Death was the supreme shock to evolving man, the most perplexing combination of chance and mystery. Not the sanctity of life, but the shock of death inspired fear and thus effectively fostered religion. Among savage peoples, death was ordinarily due to violence, so that nonviolent death became increasingly mysterious. Death as a natural and expected end of life was not clear to the consciousness of primitive people, and it has required age upon age for man to realize its inevitability.
Why don't we start with the most immediately chucklingly relevant part right at the very end there. You know, and notice that they always do this. It's like, wait a minute, there's a lot of people, maybe even me, right, that is struggling with this issue. Oh, primitive people, they said. Whoops. But again, right, I mean, that's not a, you know, just a, some sort of a, you know, dichotomy and derogatory term, right? I mean, primitive is the way we all start, inescapably. We start out as immature individuals. You can't be anything but primitive to start out with, and so when you're in those beginning stages, and they're going to explain this a little bit more as we go into the following paragraphs, it's very interesting to think about what they say here about your natural relationship to life and death. And notice in that second sentence there, they said, not the sanctity of life, but the shock of death inspired fear. You know, you might say, well, why? It should be pretty obvious. I mean, initially, you just aren't reflective enough to get the concept of the sanctity of life. Right? It's too subtle. You know, and it escapes your recognition. But death, right, doesn't, you know, there's no escaping that. That is, you know, so immediately in everyone's face. So, but this whole bit of, you see, they start out, they're mentioning the chance thing, like, see, so you begin with just this notion of chance, you know, and then, of course, the ever-present, you know, divine secret mystery thing that we have, you know, that's behind all of these musings of early religious thought. You know, so you start with that basic context, and you throw in the death element, and you know, and it's just all very mysterious. It's like, you know, what kind of hand of chance is at play that suddenly caused this person to die? And you're seeking for an understanding. It's all very mysterious. Okay, and you know, there's no initial notion that death is just a natural part of your design. And you know, the thing that you're thinking of, well, that might get you to have a little more sophisticated, you know, reflection on the nature of death is like, well, don't they think about how you know you weren't there and then you were born, and is it that surprising that this kind of reciprocates on the other end and you die and you're not there anymore? You know, but that takes, again, a lot of reflection over the whole span of your life to really kind of put the two bookends side by side like that. And so, you know, we've talked about how immediate existential thinking is. You know, so, you know, you just, I am, and, you know, is there any end to that thought? No, it just is innately eternal when you say that. See, so that's why just naturally no one is thinking that death is natural. It's like, no, what's natural is the I am thing, right? My existence that just is. And so death appears to be some sort of, you know, intrusion upon that.
Yeah, it's kind of puzzling, because primitive men lived largely by hunter. They were hunter-gatherers. They killed animals to eat and live. So it seems like...
But that just adds to their point. I mean, those animals are dying by violence. And that's totally... Okay, that's straightforward. I get it. Cause and effect, right? Okay. Stick a spear in the side of a mastodon and it dies. You stick a spear in the side of a human and it dies. But you know, what if, you know, suddenly the person has a stroke, or something, or a brain aneurysm, or, you know, and it's like all of a sudden they just die for no apparent reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of times today is, why did God do that to
him? Yeah, right. You know, that's what we're coming up on, you know, is those sorts of, yeah. Because you've got this huge mystery, you think it's unnatural what's happening here, this death thing, you know, and so someone or something had to have done it, right? And you go searching for the answer. What's the causality? You know, and as we all know, in our ignorance, we don't find any sort of initial proper causality. We imagine various causalities.
It's interesting what you said a second ago about, which I don't think we ever really think about. 100 years ago, we didn't even exist.
Yeah. You know, right.
The universe was going along, everything was going along, just hunky-dory.
Yeah.
We weren't even a thought.
Right. Everything was just fine. It's like, no, everything couldn't have been just fine.
Think about that
right,
much.
But we should, right.
It's just, yes. Existence.
Yeah. Right. Like I said, just, you know, if you want to have death be less mysterious, just reciprocate back to the birth side. And it's like, is it really that mysterious that one day you won't be here anymore? Or you, for a million years, you weren't here. Well, you know, while there were humans here, right? You know, there's been humans here for a million years, and for a million years, one of those humans wasn't you. So is it surprising that 100 years after you're born, you know, yeah. Right? There's not a you again.
But there is.
I mean, a million compared to 100, which is the normal state of affairs? not a state of affairs with you. The normal state of affairs doesn't have a you. All right, so... right, but it's just so difficult to not see. Just those are simple things where you, like, I don't put myself at the center of the universe. Yes, you do. You can't help but put yourself at the center of the universe. You define normalcy relative to your existence. You know, what else could you possibly do naturally? All right, they're going to flesh this out a little bit more here.
Early man accepted life as a fact, while he regarded death as a visitation of some sort. All races have their legends of men who did not die, vestigial traditions of the early attitude toward death. Already in the human mind, there existed the nebulous concept of a hazy and unorganized spirit world, a domain whence came all that is inexplicable in human life, and death was added to this long list of unexplained phenomena.
Yeah, so you see, if it's just that animistic world and you don't have sort of the individuated ghost spirit sort of, you know, imaginary world, it's just a hazy, unorganized fuzz of mysterious influence. But the really challenging thing in there is, see, it's not what you'd think. You know, your first thought has probably always been, it's like, you know, why do we have all these legends about immortals? Well, it's like, well, it obviously has to be, you know, from, someone like Van and Amidon being around for 150,000 years or, you know, that sort of thing. No, that isn't fundamentally why we have stories about immortals. We have stories fundamentally because we just have this initial primitive belief that we're innately immortal. Like I said, because you have this very foundational nuclear thought, I am, and it's just existential. So things like Van and Amidon and stuff, that just reinforces that pre-existent belief, you know, that they are being shielded from, you know, the visitations that I'm not being shielded from. You know, why are they special? You know, what do I have to do to be like them where I get shielded from the visitations? See, that's the basic mode that your mind is inescapably in. And everything then builds upon that starting point.
Okay? Well, that goes also into, and we all do it today, goes into, what do I have to do to live eternally?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we should not just live here on Earth, but I mean, you know, to be an eternal being.
Yeah.
You know, because oftentimes in the book they'll say, if you survive, you know, which you've mentioned many times is probably not such a big deal mm-hmm. from this world.
Right, right.
Eventually,
right.
You're going
to... Right, you have to face that at some point, yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, your mortality, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're technically mortal until you fuse with your adjuster.
But,
you know?
Interesting. You know,
yeah.
So the quote-unquote truth behind this is not just the truth of living as a human and the fearing and the death part, it's also living an eternal life that we kind of all have that desire or whatever it is.
Yeah. Right, and
that I am thing.
Yeah, that I am thing. And think about, see, how there must be room for improvement about our initial natural concepts about, an afterlife or living immortally. I mean, because initially, naturally, what you're going to be thinking about, you know, going on past this life is... you know, basically that you are innately immortal. There's some sort of visitation that temporarily turned you off, but, you know, then they just turned you back on and put you back in your natural immortal state. And that's what going on and on, you know, in the ages to come is. See, we have a very inappropriate, false concept of the afterlife. Right? Like I try to stress you so often, you know, your adjutant self is a mortal self, period. It's not resurrected. It can't be resurrected. It is nothing like what we initially think it is, like we're talking about here, innately immortal. It's the fifth epic of Revelation is basically completely turning our initial thought about immortality around 180 degrees and saying, no, it's not anything like you think. There's no relationship of your adjutant self to immortality at all. It's not innately immortal. It can't be somehow magically made immortal, you know, and made go on and on in heaven, blah, blah. There isn't anything like that. It's a totally different self. It's a self that reflects the best aspects of your adjutant self, but it's a separate self that is potentially immortal.
Separate or new?
I mean, right now there's
still the personalities.
Well, no, see, right now, again, that's the mysterious thing that the fifth epical revelation is putting forward. There's three selves sitting in this chair right now. There's the one that's talking to you, my adjutant mind self that's mortal. There's an adjuster self that's quietly in the upper reaches of my mind that was put there when I was roughly age 6 by the Father. But then there's a third self.
Soul.
Right? There's that, you know, there's a Marantia mindal self seated upon that Marantia object, that Marantia brain, my soul, that's the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the adjuster and the self that's talking to you right now. Okay? I mean, it's just, that's the potentially immortal self. That's what's resurrected. You know, and that whole concept of, you know, when the adjutant self says, I am, because there's a personality identified with it, that's, you know, initially confusing. Right, it's throwing you off. It's making you, it's giving a significance to this adjutant self that isn't really there. That potentially immortal self doesn't directly have a personality identified with it right now. It's just a functioning mindal self that is a copy of the higher meanings and values of your mortal self, and it will get that personality identified with it when you wake up on the first mansion world, and it will say I am then, right? And there will be some more validity to that thought.
And some memory which the thought adjuster brings back.
Sure, right.
There's, in terms of, right. You think we would remember that we came from the world where Jesus bestowed, our Creator Son bestowed himself? I hope so.
See, again, just notice how much tension this thought about this other self, and that's the one that's resurrected, yeah, puts into us. It's like, well, wait a minute. Yeah. I don't want to lose anything that I hold dear. Again, I mean, do you not trust God that everything that you'll want is there? You know? And that the things that you might think you want, you will soon recognize, oh, whatever. you know, it's just, right? You know, that a lot of your adjutant self right now is just like all those objects that you cherish and have in very carefully, you know, cultivated and maintained nooks in your house or whatever, right? You know, those objects aren't going to go with you either. You know, and a lot of those mental objects that are really not that different than those literal material objects, right, are left behind. You know, and you really won't miss them even though right now it's just, I mean, there's a lot of us that have tons of crap, okay? And objectively, you know, we're thinking, you know, I mean, really, I know I'm not taking any of this with me, but man, I just can't part with it. I mean, there's just so many memories of, you know, of my childhood or whatever attached to that. And I mean, I know that I'll probably never look at it again. It's in this box in the attic. But I just, you know, yeah. All right, that's just the way we are. In this life, perforce, we serve two masters. We can't help that. There's nothing wrong with that. We'll just, you know, the death is a technique to naturally get us to let go of that stuff and be totally cool with it. We won't mind that we aren't holding on to those material objects anymore, any more than we'll mind that we aren't holding on to those material mind objects anymore in the lower domain of our hourglass analogy. You know, they just go away. And, you know, you can look up in the records about what knickknacks you had. You can look up in the records, you know, about what your animal origin temperament was and whatnot. You can look it all up, okay. You know, but, you know, that stamp collection won't be on the shelf in your Marantia, you know, house, okay? Yeah.
I had to call customer service. So
okay, yeah, let's go here first. Yep.
Well, this book I just finished reading, this man's made an earnest effort to write something that's pertinent to the solving big issues that he sees in today's world.
Mm-hmm.
But religiously, he's primitive. And one of the things that he's holds up high in his mind is self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the self that it's the adjutant self that he recognizes as self.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees people like him who have education, their children are being well-educated, successful,
mm-hmm.
they have high self-esteem. But that's only good in this life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's problematic even in this life as far as being a happy, well-adjusted.
Right, so, the very fact that you're saying self-esteem and not self-respect.
Yeah. I mean, I carefully mm-hmm. noticed he did mention self-respect, and it's interesting where it came up, but it was far into the book. It didn't have anything to do with really his understanding of
mm-hmm.
of things.
Right, yeah, see, and, you know, it's there's fewer and fewer well-educated people that, you know that self-esteem is a negative word even anymore. You know? it's always interesting when you hear someone, oh, they know that that's a negative word. Because most people treat it as a completely benign positive word. It's like, no, that benign positive fact is self-respect. Self-esteem, you know, you said high self-esteem. Well, self-esteem is high by definition. See, it's overly high. By definition,
so you can have one without the other.
You haven't pegged on, you know, at self-admiration and self-love yet. Okay, you haven't taken it all the way, right? But you're on the path of a little bit of pride. See, you take self-respect, you juice it with a little pride, and you've got self-esteem. Yeah. You juice it with a whole bunch of pride, you've got self-admiration. Yeah. Nope.
you kind of answered.
No, okay.
just those memories that we have, we certainly could do our homework here, do our footwork here to increase, you know, I guess I'm not being clear, just the memories of, are they recallable just like they are to us now?
Well, again, like John was pointing out, remember there's, you know, we don't understand the physics of this. There's some memories that are quote-unquote spiritizable. In other words, they have enough meaning and value tied to them that they can be stored in the memory mechanism of the adjuster. Because remember, the adjuster is a self too, right? And, you know, a self has some memory mechanism, just like right now our brain is our memory mechanism. That adjuster has some memory mechanism too. It's obviously going to be, it's going to not be a mechanism that can store very material, you know, basal sorts of things, right? But if there's genuine meaning and value associated with a memory, it can be stored in its memory mechanism. And as soon as you're reawakened on the first mansion world, you know, you have access to that memory mechanism. Okay, and so those memories are there. But if it's something that's just tied to thing, right now your brain can store memories that are just thing memories, no meaning, no value associated with it, just thing. See, a purely thing-like memory can't be stored in that adjuster's memory mechanism. Okay.
But your concepts of God as they grow, I imagine, are more than thing.
Yeah, I mean, think about the things you really cherish. If you have any genuine concepts of God, there's more than a thing to that memory. There's value to that memory. Okay.
In this life, that capacity just gets better or greater.
Yeah.
And things that we, so if we try to live a life of meaning and value, that's gonna,
yeah,
just gonna move that much higher.
Right. Right. The more that you live a life here of meaning, the more you know that all the memories associated with that life are being stored in the adjuster. And we'll be there when you wake up. I mean, do you really want your meaningless memories, you know, haunting you up there? No, I'd like to get rid of some of my unfortunate meaningless memories. Yeah. Okay. Now back to the task at hand here. So you've got this basic notion that a primitive human has, that they're immortal. And so if the guy in the neighboring tribe doesn't run a spear through you and you just die, apparently no cause, one day, you know, everyone is wondering what happened to you. Some unseen force in this mysterious invisible world that you're formulating must have poked you in some way and caused you to die. All right, and so then it's just a matter of maturing this notion. You know, it's like they're saying, it starts hazy, unorganized, it's a vague, you know, magical sort of a notion. But a whole complicated, so, you know, apparent physics is going to be developed. Okay? All right.
All human disease and natural death was at first believed to be due to spirit influence. Even at the present time, some civilized races regard disease as having been produced by the enemy and depend upon religious ceremonies to effect healing. Later and more complex systems of theology still ascribe death to the action of the spirit world, all of which has led to such doctrines as original sin and the fall of man.
Right. See, so even when you get quite sophisticated, right, and you know, you can even have a quite scientific understanding of, you know, your living mechanism and the death of it and all that. But when all is said and done, you're going to, well, yeah, but the real reason why people die is not the physics that you're pointing at. You know, why is the physics playing out like that? And they say, well, the reason is original sin. Right? If Adam and Eve hadn't sinned, we would all be in our naturally immortal state. So this can go on as it's, you know, obviously still is today. You can have all kinds of scientific advancement and stuff, but when all is said and done, you're still in that primitive mode where you don't even recognize it. You're assuming that you're innately immortal, And the only reason you die is because of some visitation. And it doesn't have to be right now when you die. It can be just put into mankind way back in Adam and Eve days, in the biblical sense of Adam and Eve, right? And we just have inherited, right? It's transferred from one generation to the next. This death curse, right, that God put upon us.
I wonder if they froze my body before I was quite dead. I'd have a better chance of resuscitating.
Right, and we just, right. See, like I said, you can, the more sophisticated your science gets, the more you just complexify the notion. You don't ever fundamentally challenge the initial assumption that you're innately immortal. Right? And so you have all these people being cryogenically frozen and all this sort of stuff, you know, because they're innately immortal, and one day we'll be able to fix whatever's wrong with them and put them back in their innately immortal state. And it's like, you know, there's just no recognition. It's like, no, you're not innately immortal. That's the... It's science, advance in science doesn't impact philosophic assumptions. Right? They stand unmoved, you know, in the face of complexifying theology or complexifying science. Right? And that's what they're trying to point out. No one has yet challenged that basic philosophic assumption that you're innately immortal. And now we just have to figure out how to stop the visitation of chemistry or the visitation of physics or the visitation of a spirit being or the visitation. Yeah. It's like, no, it has nothing to do with any visitation. Okay?
There's an expiration.
You're just mortal. Okay?
He's frozen, but the expiration
is the same. Yeah. Okay. I don't want to start a whole aside, but you know, not to mention, think about how much the assumption that time is a reality feads into this. Mm-hmm. You know, what if time is not a reality? What if time is merely an appearance? Yeah, how does that impact all of your notions about this? You can see they literally say, like I said, it's just the later and more complex systems of theology. It just, you just add wheels within wheels within wheels in all these theories, but no one is going, you know, this is so incredibly complicated and convoluted now. Do you suppose this is telling me that maybe my initial assumption is not valid? You know, that I have to have it so complicated to get the correct answer? You know, that's the fifth epical revelation is very fundamentally about challenging those initial philosophic assumptions. It's not trying to give you a whole even more complex theology, you know, to rationalize your same old false initial assumption with. That's putting new wine in old wineskins. Let's see, I think I got everything there right. Let's see. Oh, just, yeah, notice that they're bringing in, you know, once you start with the most obvious thing of death and think you rationalize that, the next thing is to bring in disease, you know, and kind of a whole spectrum of disease. Also, they point out our natural tendency to think in dichotomies once we start thinking about the quote-unquote spirit world. You know, there's going to be the enemy, right, in quotes there. Right? And it doesn't have to be the devil or Satan or Lucifer. I mean, you know, whatever tribe or, you know, they've got, you know, they're going to have some good, bad notion. You know, there's going to be someone that's quote-unquote the enemy. You know, maybe it's Loki, you know, or whatever, right? But there's going to be the enemy. All right.
It was the realization of impotency before the mighty forces of nature, together with the recognition of human weakness before the visitations of sickness and death, that impelled the savage to seek for help from the supermaterial world, which he vaguely visualized as the source of these mysterious vicissitudes of life.
Just notice the one little thing they threw in there that they said, they didn't say supernatural, but they said supermaterial. Mm-hmm. You know, they're reminding you that there's sort of an unrecognized, subtle sophistication that starts to happen. You start out just, you know, in a very magical, superstitious, just contrast to the natural, the quote-unquote supernatural. But see, you know, no matter how not real your spirit notion is, you know, the more you kind of definitively have some sort of spirit notion, quote unquote, you know, you're actually starting to get a contrast between material and spiritual, and hence a super material. And it's like, I don't really mean supernatural. I'm thinking spirit's natural, right? It's just it's super material. And that, yeah, obviously that sophistication of recognition is not going to be there in any significant way. But see, they're pointing out it actually is unconsciously there. You're priming the mind to eventually go, you know, wait a minute, you suppose there literally is another stuff, spirit stuff, they're just, like I said, they're reminding you that we've long had the kind of beginning recognition of this fact. We just have never taken it that final step that the fifth epical revelation encourages us to do. It's like, don't just imagine some spirit world that's some sort of an extrapolation of the material world. Just cut the whole tie at all. There's just an absolutely separate stuff. It doesn't stem from the material. It just is like matter just is. And the two stand side by side in absolute presence, and then things happen from there. And that's what they're wanting us to eventually get to. But as they're going to describe early on, everything is just being rationalized stemming from the material. And they're going to explain how that process gets started. Let's see here. Anything else there? Let's see. Just notice that, you know, they're pointing out the complexity of the impotency before the mighty forces of nature, together with the recognition of human weakness before the visitations. So, it's naturally complex. You know, you're considering the environment and yourself in developing this system. Okay, let's go on to the next one here.
Section 4, the death survival concept. The concept of a supermaterial phase of mortal personality was born of the unconscious and purely accidental association of the occurrences of everyday life plus the ghost dream. The simultaneous dreaming about a departed chief by several members of his tribe seemed to constitute convincing evidence that the old chief had really returned in some form. It was all very real to the savage, who would awaken from such dreams reeking with sweat, trembling and screaming.
I hope that doesn't happen to you too often anymore anyway. But a lot of us, you know, when we're very young, start out in that mode. You know, a lot of young kids, you know, are very, very, you know, struck by dreams like that.
I have two sisters that, that are in their early 60s. Mm-hmm. And when my mother died, they thought for sure that she mm-hmm. came and talked to them in their dreams. I mean, yeah. I know a lot of people like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Think that, they're being... So I sort of...
Yeah.
And it's not a scary one, but
right.
it's right. still the same concept.
Yeah. And so... So notice that there's, as they start out there, there's two elements. There's, like I said at the end of the previous one, you have the whole environment thing, and then you have the individuals. And you notice lots of accidental associations, right? And you have a very tenuous concept of causality. Right, and so you tend to just two things that are juxtaposed, spatially or temporally, you assume that they're causally linked. So you have all of these accidental associations that catch your attention. It's like, wow, look at that. That happened at the same time that happened, or, whatever. And then this very powerful, very mysterious thing that you experience while you're sleeping. Just think about how could a primitive person think anything else? I mean, dreams can be very, very precise. I mean, how are you going to convince yourself that you aren't in some real place? I mean, especially when not only is it hyper precise, I mean, everything has... nothing has a haze filter over it. Nothing, everything is in sharp focus, and every minute detail of every object is all there with all the smells and sounds and everything. Not only that, but a lot of times that very precise dreamscape is no place that you've ever been. Right. If it was always someplace, where you'd been, maybe you'd slowly over time say, maybe this is just a memory that I'm working with here. But when you've never been in this building, right? And of course, back then they wouldn't be dreaming of buildings, but now, we know about buildings, and so your mind takes the concept of a building and it builds a totally original building that you've never been in with all the detail you could ever expect to experience in that building. To come to the conclusion, I know it appears to be utterly real, but it isn't. I mean, that's not an easy thing to do. Okay? And then, like they pointed out, when you bring in beings that you interact with, and the full interaction is there, you have a full conversation with, your dead relative or whatever, and it's a wonderful back and forth, and it's everything, it's not the next best thing to being there. It appears to be being there. So because our minds are so sophisticated, see, this is trying to remind you. I mean, even today, there's almost no one alive that thinks about the fact of mind. Right? They basically think you're a fancy blob of molecules. There's all these magical things that happen to you. And, we've talked about this many times. I mean, no one, when someone has some mysterious experience, they never go, it could be my mind. My mind is very, very sophisticated and can do all kinds of things. No one ever starts with that assumption. It's like, that was so sophisticated, it can't be me. It has to be some visitation. It's like, no. I mean, the creative mother spirit is a rather sophisticated being, capable of slightly complex doings. I mean, seriously. I mean, we're talking about a being the size of Nebadon, right, whose mind that you're using. I mean, there's no limit to the sophistication that could go on in that mind energy system. I mean, when you think about it that way, it's like, why would I ever assume that there's some sort of visitation? I mean, with all of the potentials that she has in her mind energy system, it's probably just within the mind. Yeah. The primitives obviously didn't have any thought like that, because no one even has that thought today, even. And so the dream had to be some real experience. Now, you know, your friends that are sleeping around you or whatever can testify that your body was laying there by the campfire all night long or something. So you quickly figure out that, well, my body didn't go off somewhere. You know, so there's got to be some other part of me, right, that went off somewhere. You know, and obviously that, you know, that gets the whole ball rolling with, yeah, that other part of the chief, you know, is there. And that other part of me went and visited that other part of that chief there. You know, we have had these doings. This must be Ghostland. You know, and the ghost is the other part of me, the part I can't touch. you know, just the word ghost. You know, this last line when it says, you know, they wake up from their dreams reeking with sweat, trembling and screaming. I mean, the word ghost literally means that which frightens you, the thing that frightens you, the frightening thing. See, so that's, you know, that's what that word is. That word is predicated on what they're saying at the end of that paragraph there. How terrifying this was. So it's that terrifying object, right? The ghost. All right. What else do they say here?
The dream origin of the belief in a future existence explains the tendency always to imagine unseen things in the terms of things seen. And presently, this new dream ghost future life concept began effectively to antidote the death fear associated with the biologic instinct of self-preservation.
Yeah, so, you know, once you go, oh, well, okay, I just, you know, the ghost part of me just goes on and into the ghost land, and maybe death isn't that bad. Now, and think about how that could lead to, say, Viking warriors that have no fear of death and fight with incredible ferocity, you know, because they can hardly wait to get to Valhalla and have a beer. See, that's what they're talking, you know, sort of things what they're talking about. I mean, once you have no doubt that Ghostland is real, right, the basic fear of death is at least severely mitigated. You know?
Yeah, the ISIS virgin thing.
Yeah, or whatever you imagine on the other side, whatever delights, you know.
It's almost the
be it beer or virgins, you know.
Valor is, it almost defines what valor is.
Right, right. Right, did you identify more with the ghost land than, you know, the material land? Yeah. Okay, so, but the other little thing they threw in there, so the dream origin of the belief in a future existence explains the tendency always to imagine unseen things in terms of things seen. All right, see, if, like I was saying, if this initial, you know, it's ghost land, it's eventually going to be spirit land. So this initial notion of spirit is all stemming from matter, fundamentally because, right, when you're in the dream, it's all, right, it's a material house or a material whatever, right? You're walking on material ground through material grass, you know, whatever. So, you know, that's why we, all of our notions of the spiritual are just extrapolations of the material, because it all goes back to dreams. Now, obviously, none of us are dreaming about spirit substance. There's no way to dream about spirit substance. I mean, our mind literally can't hold such, you know, sensations right now. So there's no way to dream about such things. And so that's why. Think about, you've got all of that is just there. You've got, if you're going to get to a religion of the spirit, you have to somehow overcome a million years of this mode of approaching spirit, right, as extrapolating from the material. You know, and it's not. You know, it's absolutely separated from the material. It literally takes a leap of faith across that absolute divide to a totally different stuff. Okay.
Which you can't sense at all.
Right. 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 So you see how mysterious this is, and not to mention how limited our success is going to be in this life with such things. But we can have some initial success because of grace, right? I mean, by grace, you know, we have a faith grasp, okay, no matter how unconscious we are of it. Yep.
Well, our only real relationship to it then is through our mind, so we can think about it, potentially we can think about it logically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the right. Value does not come from material things.
Right.
Value has to come from spirit, right. Substance.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just...
It's just, mysterious how right. that just, happens.
Yeah, you know, use your mind to abstract that definitively apart from matter. And you can hold it apart, even though you can't put the two stuffs in front of you and poke them, you know, side, alternatively, you know.
Spirit is something we can objectively see, but it can be part of our subjective experience. Well, it is part of our subjective experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we actually do have an upper, you know, interface of our mind, you know, that touches upon spirit stuff. It's just that we don't have any direct sensory mechanisms, you know, across that, you know, that interface like we do to the material side. So these, you know, we're kind of, the stimulations of our mind by spirit stuff is inescapably less focused, right? Because we don't have it anchored in any direct sensory mechanisms, it's not going to be as focused as, you know, your image is via being anchored by my eyeballs.
Oh, but I'm spiritual, not religious.
All right.
I'm wondering if I could see that.
Yeah, I mean, if someone says, I'm very, very spiritual, you can just remind yourself, I can see you still. So maybe you're still a little material. The other little thing kind of between the lines there, when they, you know, when they talk about the new dream, ghost, future life concept, you know, that whole system you're establishing, appreciate that is going to be kind of a generalized mode that you'll go forward with and apply in different ways. That's why they're saying it like that. You know, you hyphenate it all together like that. Dream, ghost, future life concept, you know, don't just think of that refers to some specific, you know, in this case, primitive system, but it's going to be a general modality that you're going to use to rationalize things. See, because of that, you know, because of the completeness of that, the complexity of that, see, it furthers this difficulty in having your mind based upon facts rather than illusions. Right? The more that you develop a very complete lifestyle solution system that you can think in that is, you know, almost totally based upon illusions and not facts. You know, even though initially, like I was saying, initially you might be just applying it in this sort of religious mode, but it's there to kind of be the framework for the way you approach a lot of other things too. And that's why we so often talk about this, that it doesn't matter if you're talking about governmental issues, even science, so-called scientific issues, or whatever it might be, it ends up getting, you know, being able to be played out in this well-established modality of your mind, of this dream, ghost, future life concept, see, system thing. You know, you've trained your mind to kind of be content in itself. And you know, and so everything can kind of just play in there, and you don't have to humble yourself relative to facts as much as you should. Okay, that's the other thing that's kind of between the lines, and then you know, saying mouthfuls like that with all these hyphenated words together. Right? Okay.
Early man was much concerned about his breath, especially in cold climates, where it appeared as a cloud when exhaled. The breath of life was regarded as the one phenomenon which differentiated the living and the dead. He knew the breath could leave the body, and his dreams of doing all sorts of queer things while asleep convinced him that there was something immaterial about a human being. The most primitive idea of the human soul, the ghost, was derived from the breath dream idea system.
Okay, so here's yet another one of these. I have a breath dream idea system. Okay, so we have the basic framework that they set up, that dream ghost future life concept frame. And now we want to get, technically we want to get more scientific about this, quote unquote, more precise. So remember how they highlighted that you really kind of have not so much just the vagueness of supernatural, but the more precise notion of supermaterial, okay? Or as they're saying there, immaterial. See, convinced in there was something immaterial, right, about a human being. So you have this vague notion, I'm looking for that which is immaterial. It's like, well, what, to me, what does material mean? Well, it means it's very tangible. You know, I can wrap my hand on it. So this quote-unquote immaterial thing I'm looking for, it's got to be the least tangible thing I can think of or sort of observe, right? See, so you're looking for that. Oh, what about that breath thing? I mean, you know, someone can breathe that. I try to grab it, but it just, you know, it does, I can't hold on to it. Maybe that's the immaterial stuff, that breath. So that's the most rudimentary thing that they hit upon. They're budding philosophers, see, right? See, and they know they're looking for something quote unquote immaterial, and so they go for the least material thing they can find. The breath. Okay. And I've said many times, and we'll get to it again here in a little bit, remember that in Latin the word spirit, spiritus, is just literally the word for breath. Right? If you want to say, know, look at my breath in the cold air. You say spiritus, right? That's the word for breath. Okay.
Respiration.
Yeah. Or, yeah. Right. There's a lot. I mean, all of these, you know, a lot, or not all of them, a lot of these fancy words that are not body that we have, you know, like even, you know, animus, anima, things like that. You know, we just talked about animism. I mean, you know, a lot of those sorts of fancy non-body words that we have are literally just the word for breath. You know, or maybe in a more generalized sense, air, or, you know, or something like that. Wind, or, okay. So this is the most rudimentary thing, that this quote-unquote immaterial thing is going to be the breath, and everything's going to be rationalized relative to that assumption. And as soon as it becomes a religious concept, you know, it isn't just a scientific statement, the breath of life. This is a statement that just to say it invokes a deep reverence in your mind. The breath of life. Okay? All right? And we all know how that carries right forward to today. And the revelators know that. They know how basically we think in those terms. And so the book is constructed in an evolutional way. Lots of places in the book, they use that terminology. Okay? It's up to you to not be too simplistic about it and be literally thinking of breath like the primitive was. But that's what you will do naturally. Even if you think you're not literally thinking about breath, just hearing the word breath is going to make you, right, degrade the concept in your mind, right, and have it be too literal. All right. Let's see.
Oh,
yeah, got a question? Yeah.
You know, you mentioned animism a couple of times. What's the difference between pantheism and animism? Is there a difference?
Yeah, I mean, pantheism, right? There's many gods there. Okay, that's the ghost cult thing turned into lots and lots of fancy beings, but animism is just, there's no beings, there's just some vague, fuzzy, magical, quote-unquote, spirit, you know, that's everywhere and in everything.
In every rock and every...
Right, that's...
It's not pantheism.
Yeah, and see, and it's not... Animism is, more literally, the recognition of life animation, right? That's why the revelators use that term, life animation, right? It's that fact of life animation being spread everywhere, as opposed to some, you know, going to ghost and then to spirit being and having some vague spirit stuff that you then spread everywhere as spiritism, right? The difference between animism and spiritism, okay, in one sense they're kind of the same, but technically animism is not as sophisticated. It's not like you've gotten up to some vague concept of spirit and spread it everywhere as spiritism. You just have that, what's right in front of you. I'm animate. You know, and you spread that animate fact everywhere.
So when God is everywhere in everything, and then, you know, there's obviously some truth to that to some extent in mm-hmm. terms of the fact that, but, you know, when people look at as God as that versus, you know, a personality, so to speak, what do you call that? Is that what you call animism? When, you
know, well,
I mean, everything's God. You know, I mean, God is everywhere.
Right. So you can, if you keep going with the ghost to spirit to God thing, like we have been, eventually you can get to a sort of maximization of that God, bottom-up God notion that's technically a God the infinite concept, where there really is just that one fact, and we're all within that one fact. You know, and all the objects are all within that one fact. And that's the as the revelators say, the colossal error of capital P pantheism. So not lowercase p pantheism, but capital P pantheism, where you know, there's just one personalized deity, you know, and really we're all just in the Godhead. I'm not really a separate being. I'm all, you know, and that table really isn't separate. All of this is just with,
one.
Is all just within God. And it's like, no, that's a colossal error, capital P pantheism.
We become it.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, if you...
Which
if,
is different than in God we all live, breathe, and have our being, so to speak, is different.
Yeah, yeah, and... see, now there is definitely spirit presences. There's also deity presences, but you have to you know, appreciate that even though these things in some sense are co-present, they're not you know, within. Like the matter is not within the spirit. It's, you know, the spirit is co-present with the matter. You don't want to absorb the matter in, you know, or yourself inside the spirit stuff. Or like in, like you're saying, everything gets absorbed inside the God stuff. Okay, that's taking it too far. You know, you really are a separate being. You really have a separate personality from the Universal Father. You're not just a, you know, a dream object in his mind.
You, but is that table? What is that table?
And the same way with that table, right? Okay. That table is not a dream object in God's mind, right? It's not within God's mind at all. It's outside, not inside. And now, when you're talking about the Universal Father, that presence that you can, you know, conceive of, is because the Universal Father is what he is. You don't want to think of that presence as a ubiquity. It's an omnipresence. He's...
Even the third source and center is not ubiquitous.
Yeah, I mean, the existential facts are not down inside. They're on the outside, touching everything on the inside from the outside. The experiential deity, okay, is actually on the inside, and is ubiquitous. See, unlike the first person, the second person, and the third person also have mother deity, the eternal mother, son, the infinite mother, spirit. They have their existential part that's on the outside, but they have glued to that in a very mysterious, transcendent way, an experiential part that's on the inside. So that there's mind gravity, and there's spirit gravity, for instance, on the inside. It's because they're present through their experiential deity. It's a little different, but you know, the you know, setting all those complications aside, just that, you know, in him we live and move and have our being. That thought, okay, don't think of that as he's ubiquitous, right? That presence is an omnipresence. The Father is on the purely on the outside, but he touches every point on the inside from the outside. Okay, he's, you know, he's not divorced from the inside, bounded away from it, but he is on the outside. So that's what you mean by omnipresent. See, and if you put him on the inside, you end up with that God, the infinite thing, the Spinoza, like Spinoza, with a colossal error of capital P pantheism, where you end up just like, well, I guess I'm not really real. We're all just thoughts in the Godhead. You know, he's just thinking us like I think the beings and things in my dreams. It's like, no. You're not just mental objects in the mind of God.
He thinks, therefore I am.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Right. Okay. Let's see, now back to this. Okay, so the breath thing. Yeah, so we add this, the way we're going to be a little more scientific about ghosts, if you will, see, is that the ghost is the breath. Okay, and that breath is your budding concept of spirit stuff, right? Immaterial stuff. Okay, let's see. Anything else there? Right, like this, and you remember how relevant that is, right? For all the early part of human existence, you know, we were during the Ice Age, right? And there's lots of ice, right? And the better humans that are thinking up the better notions like this are all going north. They have an instinct to go north, closer to the ice. So, it all is a vast conspiracy, sort of the climate and everything to lead to this breath dream idea system. Okay.
Eventually, the savage conceived of himself as a double, body and breath. The breath minus the body equaled a spirit, a ghost. While having a very definite human origin, ghosts or spirits were regarded as superhuman, and this belief in the existence of disembodied spirits seemed to explain the occurrence of the unusual, the extraordinary, the infrequent, and the inexplicable.
Because, of course, you're making up the physics as you're going along, so of course it's going to explain the unusual, the extraordinary, right? Or at least, you know, seem to, like they said they're explained. You know, that's just why quantum mechanics can seem to explain, right? Because you're just making up the physics as you go along. So, of course, it explains everything.
We have a logical mind. It's not logical.
Right. Even if we have limited objects to work with, it's still logical.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's like, well, I got my body, I got my breath, right? You got limited objects, right? But you make it work. You come up with a scheme. You can rationalize anything, okay? And you don't want to just merely rationalize, like Gene is saying. You're going to want to have a whole system, right? You're going to rationalize until it seems like you've fleshed out a whole worldview, okay? Because there's that synthetic, logical desire, no matter how primitive it is, okay? And so you can see how it's this rudimentary, quote-unquote, science. You know, you even talk about it in mathematical terms. The breath minus the body equal the spirit. See, that sort of thing. See, like I said, that's what the breath, you know, adding the breath thing. You're trying to get a physics to this and understand precisely how this all works. And it all seems to make complete sense. Okay. Because you can't see mind energy. You can't see spirit substance. You certainly can't see life animation, right, or any of these genuine additional elements that make the body mysterious. Right? So you just put all that stuff, the life animation, the mind energy, the spirit, everything, all gets glued into the breath concept. And when they said that, while having a very definite human origin, ghosts or spirits were regarded as superhuman. Why were they regarded as superhuman? Because remember, we initially were thinking it was super material. You know, it wasn't just immaterial. It was technically super material. It's like, well, why was it super material? Well, that goes back to, you know, why was it supernatural? Remember, humans begin to recognize the vertical dimension within them. You know, and so that gets blended into their schemes one way or another. Okay. They have to have something that's vertically separated in their scheme because they recognize that vertical extent within themselves. I have higher thoughts and lower thoughts, right? As soon as you get that notion that, wow, that was a better me yesterday than today, I mean, you know, in a vertical sense, you project that into all of your scheming about how things work. Okay. So it starts out in this dual thing, body and breath. Okay, then what else do we have here?
The primitive doctrine of survival after death was not necessarily a belief in immortality. Beings who could not count over 20 could hardly conceive of infinity and eternity. They rather thought of recurring incarnations.
Okay, so just our limited extent is going to condition this so that you end up, instead of imagining along some infinite line, you know, you start extending out and, oh, it wraps back around again, right? And you get some sort of a reincarnation concept, just because you can't reach very far abstractly. You know, initially, the number three was too abstract, right? You know, they're talking, get more sophisticated, and still you kind of run out of abstraction ability, you know, at 20. It's just too abstract. And so, you know, anyone with that sort of a limited abstracting ability, they can only draw, you know, from a starting point so far, and you know, it's just going to naturally wrap back around again. Okay. All right. So, you know, you can see that you can and think about how fascinated humans have been by this. You know, it's like, I can't literally draw an infinite line, but isn't it fascinating that the essence of that infinite line is in a circle? And I can just go around and around and around and around, and it's like it captures the essence of the infinite line.
I think I see Grandpa and that baby.
Yeah, well, that's coming up in the next paragraph. You're jumping ahead.
You're your own grandpa.
Right. Yeah, so, yeah, Gene is teasing here, foreshadowing what they're going to bring up in the next paragraph here.
The orange race was especially given to belief in transmigration and reincarnation. This idea of reincarnation originated in the observance of hereditary and trait resemblance of offspring to ancestors. The custom of naming children after grandparents and other ancestors was due to belief in reincarnation. Some later day races believed that man died from 3 to 7 times. This belief, residual from the teachings of Adam about the mansion worlds, and many other remnants of revealed religion, can be found among the otherwise absurd doctrines of 20th century barbarians.
Okay, there's a bunch of things there. Why don't we start with the barbarians first? because that's another one of their little jabs.
A lot of friends who are barbarians.
Right. They're just, you know, in this spectrum of savage, right, being the most primitive, a little more sophisticated, you're barbarian, a little more sophisticated, you're semi-civilized. Right. I mean, most of religious concepts amongst the more sophisticated people on the planet are technically not semi-civilized theologies. They're barbarian theologies, is what they're trying to point out there. They're very, very natural, evolutionary schemes. And that's the essence of what they mean by barbarian. I mean, to get a semi-civilized religious scheme means it has a very significant amount of revelatory input into it. Okay? Not just little oddball tidbits like they're pointing out, you know, but basically the substance of the whole scheme is just developed through the evolutionary process, kind of reaching its heights of wheels within wheels of sophistication. Okay? That's technically just a barbarian theology. That's what they're getting at there. All right, maybe just go backwards through the paragraph now, as long as we started at the end. Think about the seven, right, is direct. Right? You are, in a sense, very similar to what you now think of as death. You will die seven times. Right, because there are seven resurrection halls. If you're being resurrected, that means before you were resurrected, you died. So, right, you die and are resurrected on the first mansion world. You have to be turned off, in the sense of dying, and are resurrected on the second mansion world, et cetera. And the final resurrection hall is on the seventh mansion world. And so, those transitions where, you can't just be morphed into a form that has a greater capacity while you're fully conscious and engaged by everything. Now, I mean, you literally have to just be turned off and they have to start totally from scratch, build a whole new body, right? And put your soul into it and all that. I mean, there's seven very much death-like transitions. And so, see, Adam talked about that, and they remembered that. And some of them, kind of lost the seven, and, maybe you ended up with three or whatever, okay, eventually. But they're just pointing out, you can have what's mostly just very primitive, evolutionary, religious schemes with a little tidbit thrown in like that. It's like, oh, whoa. Okay, they're thinking about being reincarnated as crickets, but... where did they get the seven thing? See, okay, so that's what they're getting at. Let's see here. Okay, then the thing that Gene pointed out, you obviously are going to sort of just let it go. The similarity between child and parent. Because it's like, well, that child can't be a reincarnation of the parent. The parent is still alive. I'm looking at him. But most likely, especially in primitive cultures, the grandparent is dead. Because, like they said, it was a violent life and people didn't live that long. Little Billy, is the reincarnation of grandpa. Because look how much he looks like grandpa. Let's call him Billy, because Grandpa's name was Billy.
I thought it was
Tom. All right. So, yeah, that...
Flintstone.
You've got that. That's so that genetic inheritance thing, feeds into this scheme. Now, the first thing, the orange race was especially given to the belief in transmigration and reincarnation. Obvious thing for you to say after you read that sentence is, why? And I've talked about this a lot before, but again, obviously it must have something to do with which adjutant Orange Man favors, out of the seven. He favors the third adjutant. So what's, think about, some of the subtler facts about that energy of loyalty, that spirit of courage. So as you if you go through the first three adjutants, the first one's the individuality-like adjutant, second's the associativity-like adjutant, the third's the unity-like adjutant. So see, the third adjutant, it's in that very level of the flesh, foundational sense, it's that first essence of a bit of transcendence of the material, right? And the individuality, because it's the unity-like one. So just kind of innately in its nature, it's going to kind of give you this little sense of, ooh, you know, of transcending the lowly plane of the flesh. But more than that, I mean, it's an impulse that powers you up to the second level of meaning. Right? As you can kind of think, you know, as you go through the spectrum of the first level, one, two, three adjutants, right? That third one is going to be the punch that's going to take you up to the second level, you know, and then you go four, five, six on the level of the feelings, right? And the sixth one is going to be the punch that takes you up to the third level of meaning, the seventh adjutant. I see. So that fact that impulse, you know, is, you know, they, if you identify really strongly genetically, like they did with that, they actually unconsciously pick up on that kick up feeling in that the functioning of that adjutant. Okay, and really fixate on this idea of transcendence. So remember, you know, they tried to literalize this by piling up stones. You know, they just couldn't help themselves. They wanted to pile up stones because they wanted to visualize, literalize, transcending the lowly plane. Their origin. They wanted to literalize transcendence. See, and it's all because they favor the third adjutant. Okay. And you know, and the specific that, you know, this first punch up is starting at the lowly level of the plane, you know, like the literal plane that they're piling up the rocks relative to. See, it's a lot more abstract when you think about the sixth adjutant in Redman and that impulse up. See, I mean, you're already divorced kind of from the plane, so you're not going to be so literal about this reincarnation, transmigration, transcendence, piling up rocks sort of thing, right? It's, you've already bounded yourself away from kind of that more literal mode. But not Orange Man. See, he's going to be very literal about that. Okay. All right, let's keep going here.
Early man entertained no ideas of hell or future punishment. The savage looked upon the future life just like this one, minus all ill luck. Later on, a separate destiny for good ghosts and bad ghosts, heaven and hell, was conceived. But since many primitive races believed that man entered the next life just as he left this one, they did not relish the idea of becoming old and decrepit. The aged much preferred to be killed before becoming too infirm.
See, another reason why you had the convenience that there's no living grandparent there. So the reincarnation rationalization scheme works because they checked out early, so that their body would still wouldn't be too decrepit, for, you know, in the next life.
Which most of them never got to, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, we always kind of even joke about how there's no old people in a Viking village. that concept. The most dreaded thing for a warrior was to get old. You know, he wanted to die young in battle, right? So he's in his full flower in Valhalla, you know, or wherever, right?
But is he? Did they survive?
What was that?
If they didn't have a TA, would they survive?
If someone didn't have a thought adjuster, no, of course they didn't survive. But, you know, remember, you've got you have spiritual lineages, if you will, right? I mean, people getting thought adjusters because their parents have thought adjusters. You know, we're talking about the most andite, you know, cream, so there's going to be a lot of people there that are getting adjusters naturally when they're kids because their parents have adjusters. It doesn't matter, you know, how primitive their religious notions were. That has no bearing on whether or not they have a thought adjuster, which is kind of what we're reading about here, right? I mean, we're trying to separate all of these notions about the afterlife and spirit and religion and whatnot from the facts. Yeah. Obviously, something predicated on rationalizing dreams is utterly irrelevant to the facts of survival. Okay, so he's got this future life, right, that's just like this one, minus all ill luck. Again, we're thinking, remember, you're thinking about that natural immortality, and we mentioned that before, you know, I mean, so someone who's living for 150,000 years like Van and Amidon, they're in that absence of ill luck above, brought down below here, and they're living, see, in the absence of ill luck, and that's why they don't die. Then eventually you get dual spiritism. We'll talk about that down the road here a bit. You know, that technical term. But good ghosts and bad ghosts, you know, the dichotomy comes in. And so, you know, you eventually have to have a heaven and hell then, you know, in your scheme. Anything else there? That bit about... But since many primitive races believe that man entered the next life just as he left this one. Okay, well, there's a measure of truth there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, your soul picks up in the next life exactly where it left off in this life. See? So even though they weren't thinking about it in proper fashion, notice, interestingly, they have the essence of the truth of it. You do pick up right where you left off. It's just not that mortal self. It's that potentially immortal self that picks up right where it left off. Okay.
Almost every group had a different idea regarding the destiny of the ghost soul. The Greeks believed that weak men must have weak souls, so they invented Hades as a fit place for the reception of such anemic souls. These unrobust specimens were also supposed to have shorter shadows. The early Andites thought their ghosts returned to the ancestral homelands. The Chinese and Egyptians once believed that soul and body remained together. Among the Egyptians, this led to careful tomb construction and efforts at body preservation. Even modern people seek to arrest the decay of the dead. The Hebrews conceived that a phantom replica of the individual went down to Sheol. It could not return to the land of the living. They did make that important advance in the doctrine of the evolution of the soul.
Okay, let's step through that. All kinds of little details there. Like they say in that first sentence, obviously there's going to be as many schemes as there are tribes, basically. Okay, so it's all very complicated. But you don't have the full heaven and hell thing like we have in Christendom, right, initially, but you do, you know, get this dichotomy of destinations developing, and you have the underworld of Hades, and notice just by them saying such anemic souls, right, you know, that, you know, they're, in other words, they're, you know, they're without blood, the literalness of that. So obviously, going, it's probably not going to just be breath. It sounds like blood is going to be part of this rationalization of the mysterious too at some point. And then the fact that they're supposed to have shorter shadows. I bet shadows are going to get involved in this rationalization scheme here at some point. Now, the little aside there is, wait a minute, couldn't they just take a robust individual and a so-called anemic individual have the exact same height and stand and notice that their shadows have the same length? So again, no, see, that's too factual, right? They don't base their thinking on something directly factual like that. Seems like, well, that theory would be easily refutable, wouldn't it? Like, not if you don't have a relationship to facts. The early Andites thought their ghosts returned to the ancestral homelands. Again, think about the essence there. Why do you end up in paradise after your long ascension scheme?
Your ancestral thought adjuster's home.
Right, because your thought adjuster came from there, and so it returns from whence it came. Oh, return to the ancestral homeland. See, again, there's an essence of truth there that not surprisingly might be in those early Andites, right, that would have some vague memories of the reality of thought adjusters and, you know, ascensions and things like that. And then you have the very difficult thing about, believe that the soul and body remain together. And, we all know that got definitively reinforced for the Western world. By what fact?
Embalming.
No. By what fact 2,000 years ago did Western culture get that notion reinforced?
The tomb was empty.
The empty tomb. The empty tomb, yes. Right? That's why so many Christians, they're very direct about things, believe in the same way, right? The resurrection of the body and the life everlasting.
Don't cremate me.
Right? So the fact that they did that, the powers that be didn't want to have Jesus' body left behind as a relic, see, just reinforced that very primitive notion. Okay, and then the Hebrews have their underworld, Sheol is just Hades, right? It's just the underworld. But notice what they're saying there. See, that they add, how the Greeks are constantly talking about stories where someone was going to the underworld or coming back from the underworld. They have notions of being able to somehow, cross the river Styx or whatever, right? Okay. But the Hebrews, it's like, no, you go there and that's it. There's no going back and forth. That's like they're pointing out, that's an improvement, right? When you go to the first mansion world, you're not going to come back here. Not even in some seance or something, right?
or dream, right.
That's obviously, the fact that they would believe that they couldn't return to the land of the living means that they've overcome a little bit of believing that literally the chief that they're dreaming about in their dream has literally come back. So, as I was saying, it's progress. They're beginning to, have their concept of spirit land not just be a crude extrapolation of matter land, right? Via the dream scheme. All right. Okay. So that's that gets the basics of the ghost cult going. Now they want to talk a little bit more about its development.
Yeah, Section 5: The Ghost Soul Concept. The non-material part of man has been variously termed ghost, spirit, shade, phantom, specter, and latterly, soul. The soul was early man's dream double. It was in every way exactly like the mortal himself, except that it was not responsive to touch. The belief in dream doubles led directly to the notion that all things animate and inanimate had souls as well as men. This concept tended long to perpetuate the nature-spirit beliefs. The Eskimos still conceive that everything in nature has a spirit.
Okay, so it starts out kind of similar to what I was saying earlier. You know, you have all these early not body words. Okay, I mentioned ghost. You know, that's literally, you know, that which frightens. Like I said, spirit is just breath. Shade, of course, he is shadow. Phantom and specter, those are both, you know, words meaning, you know, something that appears. See, so you can see it, it's an appearance, but it's not material. See, you can't touch it, like they said. See, it's just like, you know, yourself, except that it was not responsive to touch. See, so those words, phantom and specter, are speaking to that fact, you know, that you know it's not material because you can't touch it. And that's, like I said, that's the fundamental way that we think that we, now, this, I know this couch is real because I can touch it. That's what you tell yourself. And so these are not touchable things. They are just appearances. They are phantoms, specters, the literalness of those words. Okay. You know, and the word soul is actually kind of an interesting word. There's a reason the revelators use that one for what they do. That basically is the sense of there's a vast sea, a vast ocean, and there's a drop of water in that ocean, and it's being separated from that ocean. Or at least it's temporarily quasi-separated, and then it's going to go back and melt back into the ocean if you're kind of in that Eastern mode, right, of thinking. But see, that you have this cosmic ocean, and it's in the literalness of the Maranja object that is your soul. It's the budding drop of water of that cosmic ocean. It's that cosmic construct, the warp and the woof construct. See, that is, it is attempting to separate itself from the ocean. So that sense of kind of the sea that there is in the word soul is kind of an interesting, metaphor for, for the concept of the cosmos and, you know, you as a drop of water of that cosmos that's attempting to separate. And, you know, if you choose iniquity, the drop of water just goes back in. And, you know, or even talking about when the whole ocean becomes a being, that oversoul, right, of the Supreme Being. See, that's why the revelators, you know, one of the reasons why the revelators use the word soul the way they do in the book. Okay, but like I said, it's just initially everything is just the dream double, no matter what you call it. And, remember, like we were saying, I mean, you know, if you decide that you in that dream is your dream double, is, you know, your specter or whatever you want to call it, it's like, well, it's not just you in the dream, right? There's rocks and trees and grass and birds and, you know, right, so it's like, well, all those things must be of specter stuff, ghost stuff, spirit stuff. See, how else? You know, what else can you conclude? So that's what they're saying there. See that all things, animate and inanimate, had quote unquote souls as well as men, because everything is in the dream. Okay, and so that, like they're saying that. There's going to be a tendency at the same time that you are, in a sense, breaking away from animism and getting this whole ghost notion going. The dream, since the dream has stuff besides beings in it, it tends to reanimate, if you pardon the pun, the animism. And so no wonder you end up, as you go forward, kind of with both of them in play, so that Thor is, you know, both the one-time human now now ghost spirit, right, and nature, you know, wielder. See, so that's, yeah, the dream, the fact that everything is anchored in the dream is the boat anchor, see, you know, that's holding back a lot of progress in many ways. That's why, you know, like I said, that's why it's so interesting that to see, notice that the Hebrews, you know, they were pointing out, they were making that step and starting to break a little bit from those, that anchored nature of the whole scheme, because it's being extrapolated from the material. You know, they're actually starting to let go of that a little bit, is what they're pointing out there.
Well, it seems like natural evolutionary movement that takes place, we kind of separate spirit from matter. But when we get into the modern age and start recognizing a definitive science,
mm-hmm.
and give up superstition,
mm-hmm.
the challenge is to hang it. Well, it's real easy to say, well, spirit is not real,
yeah.
because it's not tangible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, not to mention, you know, like I've said many times, I mean, we think, you know, we've separated spirit from matter. But, of course, mostly what we mean by spiritual is just fancy mind. The fact that you haven't gone all the way through mind and gotten to the other side and gotten a hold of genuine spirit, if you'd done that, no matter how much science comes into play, no matter how materialistic it might be, you couldn't be drugged back to materialism. But the fact that you just are in mind, and your material mind has a very tight immediacy to matter, it's much easier to drag what was thought to be spiritual back down and lose it. Right? You have to get across the whole mindal divide, you know, and once you're genuinely there, no amount of science will ever be in conflict with religion of the spirit, nor will it, no amount of science will ever, you know, drag you away from religion. You know, you're bounded away now from matter and can't be sort of reabsorbed into it. let's see. Yeah, keep going here.
The ghost soul could be heard and seen, but not touched. Gradually, the dream life of the race so developed and expanded the activities of this evolving spirit world that death was finally regarded as giving up the ghost, quote unquote. All primitive tribes, except those little above animals, have developed some concept of the soul. As civilization advances, this superstitious concept of the soul is destroyed, and man is wholly dependent on revelation and personal religious experience for his new idea of the soul as the joint creation of the God-knowing mortal mind and its indwelling divine spirit, the thought adjuster.
See, and that's kind of what we were just talking about, see, you know, the essence of the latter part of that paragraph, see, that if you're not going to be drugged back into just, well, I guess I'm just a collection of molecules and all that stuff was just nothing but superstition. You know, even mind is a superstition. It's like, no, okay. You know, the best way to not get into the state we're in now, where, you know, a lot of, you know, even psychologists don't even believe in the literalness of mind. Never mind, it's like, well, what do they think they're studying? You know, the surest way to prevent that philosophic materialism, see, from just being this giant sucking sound that pulls everyone back into matter, is to genuinely stake a claim on the other side of mind. And that has, you know, basically not been done in any extensive way.
First time I think they've said it in the book, right? when they tell you that their soul is the creation of your mind.
Yeah, yeah, that super additive consequence, right? Of
right. Which is total revelation, I think, for...
Yes, yes.
For me, it was, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, right. See, no human has ever had that concept in any literal way. But like I said, it's not just that literalness of kind of the relationship to the word see for the word soul that makes it the word for them to use for this super additive consequence. But, you know, there, as time went on, as humans talked about not body stuff, you know, you can notice that there are times when humans... It's like, well, you know, that human author could have said spirit there, but they didn't. They said soul. You know, and actually, he doesn't recognize it. But that's a more appropriate term. That, you know, that's what he's thinking about is more like the actual soul than, you know, like the spirit factor, the adjuster or something. So there's this subtle influence over time of the use of these words. They all started out as synonyms, right? There was just two concepts. There was body and not body, you know, and there's all these different tribes, and so there's 50,000 different names for not body, okay? But they're all talking about the exact same thing, that ghost fact, right? You know, that dream fact. But over time, humans started to use these words differently. You know, we don't treat all those words as synonyms now, you know? I mean, no current author is going to think of the word soul and the word specter as interchangeable words, utter synonyms, and you know, see those words, and so the revelators, you know, pick up on our subtle differentiation of words like that, and say, okay, let's take you're kind of getting it. Let's take it the rest of the way. You're kind of using the word moral different than the word ethical. Yeah, that's appropriate. Let's take it all the way and fully separate it. Yeah, it's a,
whole concept of the joint creation of the God-knowing mortal mind and its indwelling divine spirit, the thought adjuster. You know, for me, when I first read that, you know, that was a heavy-duty revelation for me in terms, because I've always heard the term soul, you know, and everything. I didn't really have a real good understanding of what it was, you know, and it says that every person really knows about their own soul, but... You know, you talk about it also as really it's a Maranja thing. It's not necessarily something. And so, you know, it's one when you learn all that, you have a sense of curiosity to try and, you know, be in touch with your soul or you know, somehow feel out your, you know, realize it, so to speak. And I think this is an important revelation about, okay, it's a first start of, okay, it's a creation of a God-knowing mind and the thought adjuster within me and, so I can get sort of a better feeling of what they really mean by soul, you know, as opposed to just what, you know, like a lot of times you can look at people and you can say, that person's got a wonderful soul.
Gentle soul.
Yeah.
Not just look at them, but after you know them, I mean, you can, there's something about a person who does have a, you know, I'm sure everybody has a wonderful soul, but who exudes that, and that's the term you use. You know what I mean?
Right. And now the challenge is, you know, it's like, well, okay, to what degree do we use the word soul kind of, you know, they're saying someone is soulful, do we just mean they're feelingful? You know, are we using soul, again, for, you know, to mean the level of the feelings? That's soulful music. You know, okay, it isn't literally soulful music, it's feelingful music. But okay, you know, don't overplay what I'm saying there. And the fact that you literally do have a soul, and there is some shadow cast down into your mind because of the existence of that fact. So one could start to ask the question: it's like, well, okay, this is that's really nothing to do with soul. But I think, well, wait about, like I said, what about this human author here? When this human author used the word soul, knowing what I know about the literalness of the soul from the Aranja book, that person, you know, is kind of getting at the shadow down in his mind of the soul. What he's talking about there isn't just a spiritual notion. See, what he's talking about is more of a cosmic notion. See, so to be soulful in a proper sense of saying that means that you embody the harmony that is the cosmos to some degree. And someone else could acknowledge that fact, that they see that. It's like, you're not just spiritual, you're cosmic. You're soulful. You don't just have a spark of immaterialness. You have a presence of harmony within you that serves you well through the vicissitudes of life.
Sometimes that
would be
loving nature, and it's a,
well.
You know what I mean?
Obviously, someone that is soulful would be loving. Okay. But just because they're loving doesn't mean they're soulful. I mean, see, you know, we could start to get more precise about how we use these terms. Now, and you know, of course, the Revelators use them in a very precise fashion. So, you know, the more precise you can start to think about them, the better you'll appreciate what the Revelators mean at a certain point. You know, a similar one is the word heart. Once you finally get it that every time the Revelators use the word heart, you know, they're talking about what we're analogizing in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy, totally separate from the level of the feelings. They don't mean feelings at all when they use the word heart. You know?
When a human author says something seared his heart, they're talking about their feelings.
But you could look, it's like, well, maybe, you know, it's like, well, now Jeremiah, I can tell he didn't mean feelings, did he? He was thinking more properly, say. You can see, as I'm saying, look, you can compare and contrast even authors. Some of them are very flatlander in their use of words. Others, not so much. And it's not because, you know, they really understood all this stuff. They just sort of unwittingly were attuned a little bit better. And something told them to say heart here, right, or soul here. And they really didn't know why, but it's more appropriate. You can see that because you know the real physics of these things. And you can pick up on that. So, the degree to which humans picked up on stuff like that and used words in certain ways, the Revelators are playing off of. That's why they use words, some words, the way they use them. Because it's evolutional. See, it synchronizes a bit with what we've already thought, at least the best of what we've already thought. But there's going to be more or less distortion of meaning, because maybe you don't know any of those best usages. Maybe the only thing you've ever read is very unfortunate usages of the word soul. And then you're going to totally distort what you get from the book when you see the word soul. So,
belabor this, but yeah. It's an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. It's a question. So if it's the product of your mortal mind and your indwelling divine spirit, and you, when you resurrect on the mansion walls, you know, as a soul, but it's not your mortal mind anymore, correct?
Right, correct.
So how is that?
Okay, yeah, so I was going to actually make that one little point before we went on to the next paragraph.
Oh, good, thank you.
Notice it's God-knowing mortal mind, okay? And that is a technical, God-knowing is a technical term in the Urantia book. It doesn't mean anything like evolutionary religion thinks that term means. It doesn't mean God-notion knowing, where God is just the eventual aggrandized ghost concept. Not that God knowing. All right. God knowing this is on the sixth level of meaning. Right? And once you get up to the sixth level of meaning, it establishes a whole new foundation for the essence of the domain that is the upper domain in the hourglass analogy. That upper domain, that spiritualized mind, is the God-knowing mortal mind. The lower domain is cannot be, never will be, God-knowing mortal mind. God-knowingness is totally in the upper domain. The lower domain can know notions that are called God. When we're talking about the real God, right? That soul, what's being copied, right, is that upper domain, right, in this super additive sense, right? I mean, the super additive consequence of the relationship between that upper domain and the adjuster that's in that upper domain is this third fact, the soul. Okay. It's that God knowing mind. It's that spiritualized mind. You know, when you see the word heart in the book, replace it by the words spiritualized mind. Okay? A lot of times, like I pointed out, when you see the word soul in the book, you can tell they're not talking about the Maranja object. They're talking about that upper domain. They're talking about the spiritualized mind.
So what resurrects.
Right.
So
the copy.
You started out as in your mortal body or form.
Right.
It's really not mortal.
What's resurrected is the genuinely God-knowing mortal mind, right, if you will, right, the copy of it. Not all of those barbaric notions in the lower domain.
Though you may start out there.
Like I said, the whole point is to not just bring in the God notion from the external world as it naturally comes into the lower domain, and then falsely exalt that into the upper domain, uploading that God notion. That's what humans have been doing forever. The fifth epical revelation is trying to challenge you to try something different. Try downloading the real God. Don't upload that thing. It's a product of evolutionary rationalization schemes predicated on the dream notion, right? Don't upload that. That God has a companion that's called the Holy Ghost. Is it not obvious that that's not the real God you're looking for? Okay? Find that genuine God that can only be known on the spiritual level. Find the religion of the spirit, not the religion of extrapolated matter into the dream life.
And can you do that without revelation? Or is it just a lot harder?
Well, they kind of pointed that out. You can do that via revelation, the help of revelation, if you first had the God notion erased by science. Remember, they just mentioned that. Right, as civilization advances, this superstitious concept of the soul is destroyed. Have you let science destroy the God notion yet? If you haven't, okay, we can't get anywhere yet. Until that's gone, that boat anchor is gone, you can't get to the real God. You think that's God. Until science destroys that superstitious notion and leaves nothing left, right? Only then, then is man wholly dependent on revelation and personal religious experience.
That which cannot be coordinated must be destroyed.
Yeah.
So the evolutionary soul concept is completely incompatible.
Yeah, you have to let it be evaporated from your mind. You have to trust in the real God that you haven't been able to know yet, because you've got this this breath dream idea system, or dream ghost future life concept boat anchor hanging around your neck, right? You've got to let science evaporate that, destroy that. Then and only then can spirit gravity lift you up, right? I mean, spirit gravity can't lift you up when you've got that boat anchor hanging on you. You can't get to the real God if there's something in that place. See, because, like I said, you don't just bring it into the lower domain, which happens automatically. You falsely exalt it and put it in the seat up there on the sixth level of meaning, where the real God would like to sit, but there's no place for him to sit because you've got the falsely exalted God notion sitting up there. There's no place for God to sit in your mind until you let science evaporate what you falsely have put up there. Scientific dictation, social usage, and religious dogma. You've got those three seats polluted and filled by what you drug in from, you know, the ignorant outer life. Till you let those be washed clean again, there's no place for the cosmos to sit. And, you know, remember there was an emergency when at least there was the lowest seat, common sense seat, still, you know, the cosmos could still sit there. But as soon as we had enough science to be false and bring science, that false scientific dictation up there, now there's no seat for the cosmos left. Okay, that's an emergency. That's what the book is about. Okay, but to immediate point, I mean, it's still very sad, even before it was a planetary emergency, it's still very sad when the humans really couldn't get to the real God because they had this false God sitting in God's seat on the sixth level of meaning. You gotta get him out of there. Get that false God out of there. No matter how fancy you think he is, he's not the real God. And that's why the first paragraph of the book says, well, okay, step one, your ideas of God have issues. Okay? That's the first paragraph of the book. And until we do something about that, there's no place for the real God in your mind. You're just going to ever more falsely exalt what isn't the real God and be satisfied with it. And that's what they're trying to get at. Let's read a little bit more here, quickly here.
Early mortals usually fail to differentiate the concepts of an indwelling spirit and a soul of evolutionary nature. The savage was much confused as to whether this ghost soul was native to the body or was an external agency in possession of the body. The absence of reasoned thought in the presence of perplexity explains the gross inconsistencies of the savage view of souls, ghosts, and spirits.
That's it. Just, you know, they're pointing out that you have all these notions, but you also have these facts by grace. And the two are in conflict and just make it all the more muddled up. You know, there wouldn't, you know, this whole bit of they failed to differentiate the concepts of an indwelling spirit and a soul of evolutionary nature. It's like, well, what difference does it make if they failed to that? Well, see, it wouldn't make any difference if they didn't have an adjuster. But the very fact that you have an adjuster and it's trying to do what the adjuster would like to do to help you, but, you know, like I said, you are pushing it aside and replacing it with your, you know, these notions that you're exalting and putting up there and muddling it up. it's just kind of, you know, they're basically just pointing out what I was just stressing again. You know, you can't change. It's like you decide, well, I'm giving up all that superstitious religious stuff. Well, that doesn't turn your sixth adjutant off. It doesn't matter how much you think you're going to use your religious impulse for something. You can't turn it off. So, you know, you better find something worthy to apply it to because there's no off switch on the sixth adjutant. So these people that try to divorce themselves from God, well, they just end up in some animistic mode again. The sixth adjutant is just going to give them a newfangled animism. Right? And now they're worse off than the superstitious Christian or whatever, or Muslim that they think that they're trying to separate themselves from.
So the savage's confusion is between two things that are mostly false.
like I said, it's just, yeah. This is, you know, read just a little bit more here, and then we got a good stopping place.
The soul was thought of as being related to the body as the perfume to the flower. The ancients believed that the soul could leave the body in various ways, as in 1. ordinary and transient fainting. 2, sleeping, natural dreaming. 3, coma and unconsciousness associated with disease and accidents. 4, death, permanent departure.
So like I said, see, the more sophisticated, you just develop this whole spectrum. You know, remember how we saw they were bringing in disease along with death? Well, see, you know, they're just fleshing it out even more here. Yeah, yeah, fainting on one end, right? You know, and death on the other end. You have this whole spectrum of distance of soul from body, you know, or permanence of separation of soul from body. Okay, and then this last little bit here.
The savage looked upon sneezing as an abortive attempt of the soul to escape from the body. Being awake and on guard, the body was able to thwart the soul's attempted escape. Later on, sneezing was always accompanied by some religious expression, such as, God bless you.
The reason I wanted to push even further and get to that is just to make my point I was making about those God notions. I mean, think of the primitive God notion that's in God bless you there. Is that the real God in the God-knowing mortal mind thing up there in that super? No. See, I mean, that's a God notion that is tied to sneezing. You know, it's a good thing I was awake when I sneezed or my soul would have been lost forever. It's like, well, good grief, what happens if I sneeze while I'm sleeping? I mean, this sort of primitive thinking is what we're really in. You know, it's no wonder we have a difficult time relating to the Urantia book and not, you know, not put new wine in old wineskins. It's just, but don't beat yourself up, right? Those primitive God notions were preparing you for the real God. It's an easier step to go from a primitive God notion to the real God than to go from nothing to the real God. It's a stepping stone. It's something. You know, think of it as a beginning. The God in God Bless You is a beginning. But don't think of it as an ending. Right? Let yourself be part of an evolutionary process that's trying to hint for you to keep exploring. And like I said, cross that full divide of mind and get to genuine spirit. Get up to the sixth level of meaning and be genuinely God-knowing. Have a genuine religious consciousness, a religion of the spirit.
How did I use Gesundheit? My soul has been just stable.
Yes, and plus it's kind of fun to end on a chuckle, because I was tossing out a lot of heavy things there. But anyway, we'll pick up there at that big paragraph break next time. Let's take a moment here, everyone.